The numbers presented by the survey, if contemplated at all, are daunting.
A new survey shows 50% of Alaskan women have been victims of violence. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Thursday, the 30th of September. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, an innovative solution to a unique wildlife problem in Bristol Bay.
There's no place else in the world that has this phenomenon where we have walrus going up and sliding off of a bluff.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
The Federal Aviation Administration sets rules for the operation of aircraft in airports and provides services to the flying public. Passengers are influential in making flying safer in Alaska, and when passengers know their rights and responsibilities, aviation is safer for everyone. There's more information online at faa.gov/go/flyalaska or toll-free at 1-866-357-4704. This message is sponsored by the FAA.
Alaska has led the nation in the incidence of sexual assault and domestic violence against women, but until now, there were no clear numbers on the rate of victimization. Those numbers have been found to be shockingly high. As KSKA's Ellen Lockyer reports, a new survey indicates that close to half of all Alaska women have experienced physical violence at some point in their lives.
The new Alaska Victimization Survey, released today, was conducted by the University of Alaska Anchorage Justice Center through a contract with the State Council on Domestic Violence and Sexual Assault. It is modeled on a national survey and was conducted earlier this year over a two-month period through telephone calls to 871 randomly selected women. Dr. Andre Rosé, director of the Justice Center, said Thursday that the survey is an excellent representation of average statewide estimates of the volume of assaults against women.
We asked respondents if any of their romantic or sexual partners had ever slapped them, pushed or shoved them, hit them with a fist or something hard, kicked them, hurt them by pulling their hair, slammed them against something, tried to hurt them by choking or suffocating them, beat them, burned them on purpose, or used a knife or gun on them. Overall, we estimate that 47.6% of adult women in the state of Alaska have experienced intimate partner violence at some point in their lifetime.
That percentage translates to 117,685 women in the state. Rosé said the survey does not provide estimates of incidences in distinct locations or among specific racial groups. The survey was conducted only among English-speaking adult women with cell phones or landlines. He said researchers gathered information on three types of violence against women: intimate partner violence, threats of physical violence, and actual physical violence. The influence of alcohol and drug use was factored in. The survey includes recent statistics on past year violence.
We found that 9.4% of adult women in the state of Alaska experienced intimate partner violence in the past year. If we just focus on the past year, almost 10%, or 23,240 women experienced intimate partner violence at some point in the past year.
Rosé said prior to the survey, there was no information available on the actual incidence of intimate partner violence or sexual violence in the state. The survey includes both reported and unreported offenses. Law enforcement data is insufficient, he said, because it does not include offenses that were not reported to police. The victimization survey provides a baseline for future research into the rates of rape, physical battering, and domestic abuse against women in the state, and it could be used to gain funding for programs against domestic violence, according to Sandy Samaniego, CDVSA executive director.
The numbers presented by the survey, if contemplated at all, are daunting. When we remember that these numbers represent real lives, real people, then we somewhat comprehend the heartbreak that these numbers represent. How can we possibly turn the tide on the scourge of violence that spans our state? I think we do it the same way we address every other tragedy and malady in our lives. We do it one step at a time.
Stephanie McFadden, chair of the CDVSA, said the council has been working on the problem of domestic violence for 30 years.
We deal with family violence, dating violence, rape, and child abuse. They're all big problems in our state. This is not new news to our state. Historically, we have had high incidences of domestic violence and sexual assault. But we knew that to make a difference, something had to change. The first thing we needed to know was the real size of the problem, because we knew that not all assaults are reported to law enforcement.
Alaska State Trooper Colonel Audie Holloway agreed law enforcement figures on violence against women in Alaska are not accurate.
It's probably close to maybe less than one-tenth that's reported based on what we're seeing here.
McFadden says the real-time data is to be used to move the state forward in solving the epidemic of domestic violence in Alaska. The survey cost $280,000. Rose said more information will be coming out in a report this fall. I'm Ellen Lockyer.
A member of President Obama's inner circle with connections to Alaska is expected to take one of the White House's top jobs tomorrow. Pete Rouse is likely to be tapped by the president to serve as his interim chief of staff when Rahm Emanuel officially steps down tomorrow. The White House hasn't confirmed the switch, but Press Secretary Robert Gibbs told reporters today that the president will make a personal announcement tomorrow, and then Gibbs praised Pete Rouse specifically. Rouse has Alaska roots. His mother grew up in Anchorage, and in the late 1970s, Rouse left his home on the East Coast to journey to Alaska and work for Lieutenant Governor Terry Miller, a Republican who served with Governor Jay Hammond. Rouse held that job for 4 years until 1983, when he moved to Washington, D.C. He became chief of staff for South Dakota Senator Tom Daschle, who rose to be the leader of Senate Democrats. When Daschle left office, Rouse went to work for then-Senator Obama as chief of staff and moved with Obama over to the White House to serve as a senior advisor. Senator Mark Begich praised the expected promotion of Rouse to the White House chief of staff in a press release today. He called Rouse soft-spoken and down-to-earth, while at the same time an effective political operator. Democratic Senate candidate Scott McAdams today said Alaska's congressional delegation should take a new role in helping shape the state's economy. Speaking to a labor group, McAdams said his goal is to work with a strategy to fit into an economy that fully develops oil, gas, and timbers, but also includes renewable sources of energy, what he calls stranded wind, stranded geothermal, and stranded water.
We'll put Alaskans to work. We will create a new economy in Alaska, but more than that, as we continue to develop our oil resources in Alaska, we can also become a laboratory and innovation center for renewable energy, a blueprint of which could inspire and influence the world.
McAdams says he supports oil development on the Outer Continental Shelf and opening ANWR for oil development. Randy DeSoto, spokesman for Republican Joe Miller's campaign, said Miller fully supports opening ANWR and will work with Republicans in Congress to get that done. He says Miller also supports using alternative sources to make energy affordable and accessible for Alaskans. He says, though, that having two Democrats in the Senate won't make that much of a difference.
Those who want to keep ANWR closed are true believers, and so they won't. And it's particularly in the Democratic Party, they're most bought into the idea of an overzealous protection of every spot of the earth.
Senator Lisa Murkowski's campaign staff didn't respond to a request for her response. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, what the end of a grant could mean for rural libraries and young readers.
We're a book poor state. Kids don't have books put in their hand, especially kids in rural areas.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by
First National Bank Alaska, serving Alaskans' financial needs for nearly a century. Member FDIC, equal housing lender.
And by
Northern Air Cargo. For over 54 years, Alaskans have entrusted Northern Air Cargo to transport their freight. Thank you, Alaska, for the opportunity to serve you for decades to come.
Alaskans with certain skills are going to find it easier to find jobs, even in a tight job market. And money coming to the state under the 2009 stimulus bill is going to help train low-income workers for jobs in high demand. KMBA's Jacqueline Estes has more.
Alaska is getting about $1.6 million to provide health care training to low-income individuals. The grant is coming from the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services. The state of Alaska will get about $150,000. Most of the grant, almost $1.5 million, will go to the Cook Inlet Tribal Council, or CITC. CITC's Managing Director for Grants and Planning, Christy Allen Willer, says this is the first installment of a larger grant.
That's for this year. It is a five-year grant, so over the course of 5 years, it will look more like a little over $7.5 million.
The grant will allow CITC to offer this training for the first time, says Willer.
We'll be able to use it to prepare young people for nurses certification at three different levels: certified nurses, assistants, licensed practical nurses, and registered nurses.
Uh-huh.
We're also going to use part of it for medical coding and billing, which is very useful for people who need to stay at home and can do some of that through computers at home.
Students will attend the State of Alaska's Vocational Technical Center, or AVTEC, in Seward. At the South Central Area Health Education Center, students will observe or shadow experts in their field as they do their work. Willer says the program will offer several kinds of support.
They're not going to be paid to be students, but we will be supporting them with daycare services and other kinds of assistance so that they can be available for that training.
Willer says the training program benefits both employers and the unemployed.
We all are very excited about beginning this program and being able to both train people who need jobs in a faltering economy and especially in the health professions, which are one of the fastest growing, but there's also a real need here. So I think we're filling the need both in terms of health professions and training for people who really need jobs.
Training programs such as this do even more, though, according to David A. Hansel, Acting Assistant Secretary for the Federal Administration for Children and Families. In a prepared statement, he said the absence of qualified workers in the healthcare field threatens the quality and availability of medical care. I'm Jacqueline Estes.
Social workers from across the state and the lower 48 will converge in Fairbanks next week for the annual Alaska Chapter of the National Association of Social Workers Conference. It's the first time the event is being held in Fairbanks. Chapter President and University of Alaska Fairbanks Assistant Professor of Clinical Social Work, Laverne Dementive, says the move is aimed at broadening participation.
We primarily have had this in Anchorage in the past, and so having it in Fairbanks this year really is about saying, okay, we want to pull in other people. We want to pull in some rural communities in the northern environment. We want people to have access to these presenters and workshops.
Dementive says participants are coming from interior villages as well as Western Alaska and the North Slope. She says the three-day conference is packed with sessions dealing with a wide range of issues.
Children's mental health, eating disorders, substance abuse, play therapy, focusing around adolescence, domestic violence, HIV and AIDS in the community, cultural competence, wellness, and I think that we just have a really, really great agenda.
Presenters include Dr. Patch Adams, who will talk about humor and health, and Dr. Ann Bullock, who studies intergenerational trauma and stress-related illness. Bullock says new genetic research illustrates how stress affects the onset of diabetes and chronic disease.
We know that, of course, it matters what choices we make for diet and exercise, and it does matter what genes we inherit from our families in terms of our risk, but recent science is showing that there's a whole lot more going on than just those two things, that actually things that happen even before we're born, prenatally, what happens to us in the womb, what happens to us in our early life once we're born, have huge impacts on our later risk for developing chronic disease. And that's some science that a lot of people aren't real aware of. And it's not just heart disease and diabetes. It's also depression and substance abuse and domestic violence and a lot of the other problems that we see so often in communities.
Dr. Bullock's presentation on the medical side of social problems is part of the conference's aim of providing a more interdisciplinary perspective for participants. The deaths of hundreds of walrus at a haulout in Bristol Bay over the last several years has resulted in a unique project undertaken by the Togiak National Wildlife Refuge. KDLG's Mike Mason has the story.
The haulout is called Maggie Beach, and it's located on Cape Pierce. Paul Liedberg is the refuge manager, and he confirms that starting in 1994, refuge staff noticed that several large dunes that prevented the walruses from reaching a cliff overlooking the haulout had been eroded.
And when those dunes blew away, that provided access for these walrus to climb a gradual slope, and they would go up to that slope, up that slope and up to the bluff to rest. You know, they'd haul out for 2 or 3 days, and they'd rest up there, and then that put them in close proximity to the bluffs that when they were ready to head for the water again to go out to feed, a number of them would head straight to the water, which meant they slid down a small incline until they couldn't stop and went over the bluff.
Liedberg says there have been 5 confirmed walrus mortality events at Maggie Beach in the last 15 years, and he estimates that as many as 250 walruses have perished as a result of going over the cliff. He says efforts to try and stop the walrus mortality at Maggie Beach began immediately in the mid-90s when it was first noticed.
Some of it included herding walrus back away from the bluff. Some of it included constructing some fences where we would tie tarps up, and flapping tarps out in the wind worked to some degree to keep walrus from moving up that that incline.
In recent years, refuge staff have noticed more and more walrus activity in the area, coupled with more mortality. That has prompted the installation of a new permanent electric fence intended to prevent the animals from getting to the higher ground. Liedberg says a small-scale electric fence was tested last year, and it seemed to work. That resulted in a much larger permanent electric fence being installed at the site earlier this week. The fence is several hundred feet long, and it's powered by a solar panel mounted on a small cabin the refuge has at the site. Liedberg says the fence is basically an experiment, and the refuge will have a couple of people stationed at the site to see if it actually works.
There's no place else in the world that has this phenomenon where we have walrus going up and sliding off of a bluff. But so to some degree, it's an experiment to see if this can work. And we will have 2 people out there as late in the season as we can, probably until late October, early November, that can monitor it and see what the response is from the walrus to the electric fence.
Liedberg admits that there have been a lot of internal discussions about whether or not it's a good idea to try and change natural walrus behavior by keeping them away from the cliff. However, he says the unique nature of the problem, coupled with a request to list the walrus under the Endangered Species Act, led him and others at the refuge to decide to give the electric fence a try. While it's hoped that the new electric fence will work, Liedberg says the refuge is still considering other alternatives.
Another thing that we've tried, and I think that we are moving forward on again, is can we recreate those dunes? Can we build up those dunes again so that they effectively stop walrus from moving up this incline?
Cape Pierce is one of the 2 largest frequently used terrestrial haulouts for Pacific walrus in the U.S., but it was apparently abandoned by the walrus during the first half of the 20th century. However, walruses returned back in 1981, and they've used the haulouts in that area every year since. In Dillingham, I'm Mike Mason.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by
Arctic Wire Rope and Supply, an Alaskan company providing lifting and rigging products since 1983, on the web at arcticwirerope.com.
Hello, I'm Peter Kenyon, NPR foreign correspondent and former APRN reporter. Help support APRN's news mission by joining me on October 24th for the first of the new APRN speaker series. Go to APRN.org to reserve your ticket today.
The Matanuska-Susitna Borough Assembly has approved a plan to deal with the unpredictable Matanuska River. Earlier this week, the Assembly voted in favor of a collaborative plan to help those living alongside the river, which has caused property loss for residents due to riverbank erosion. The plan involves input of riverside property owners. It creates a team including the City of Palmer, the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers, State Fish and Game, and the Alaska Department of Transportation, among others. The new plan creates a framework for the agencies and the stakeholders in riverside property to work together on land management issues. Previously, studies on river erosion were done by different agencies. Assemblymember Lynn Woods is the borough's deputy mayor.
Since this was a joint effort of state and federal agencies, as well as residents and members of communities that are directly impacted by the river, I think this is a key tool. And the most important tool is to let folks know that living on the banks of the river is a dangerous place to be. You can't count on not being eroded away.
The plan provides $100,000 for options to improve erosion management. One method is to educate the public on the problem, while others include structural protections for the riverbank. In some cases, homeowners were moved away from danger.
Relocating homeowners from areas that are prone to erosion is one option. We did, in cooperation with a Natural Resource Conservation Agency, purchase homes up in the Sutton area, as opposed to the construction of dikes. That was a more economical tool to work in that area.
Wood says due to the nature of the Matanuska River, which is glacier-fed and wanders from one channel to another over the course of years, many property owners were unaware of the risks of erosion to riverfront properties. Children's author Will Hobbs visited Sitka last week as part of the Alaska Spirit of Reading program. Grant money puts books by a certain author in the hands of students across the state. The author then visits Alaska to meet with those students and talk about the book. But as KCAW's Ed Ronco reports, the future of the three-year-old program is uncertain.
About 107th graders are gathering in the library at Blatchley Middle School. The lights are dimmed and the chairs are arranged in rows facing a large screen. Teacher Alexander Allison steps to the front of the room.
I'd like to introduce you to Will Hobbs, the author of Blatchley Middle School's most popular novel of all time, Leaving Protection, of course, author of Wild Man Island, Far North, Jason's Gold, many other of our Sitka favorite books. Let's give a warm Sitka welcome to Will Hobbs.
These Blatchley students have just finished reading some of his books, including Leaving Protection, which is set around a 16-year-old boy named Robbie who lives in Port Protection and becomes a deckhand on a salmon troller.
Let me see. How many of you have gone out on a commercial boat, like a troller, like the one in the story? So you know. I know I'm trying to get everything right about the gear and everything because I only worked on a boat for a week. You know, so you know a lot more about it actually than I do, but I wanted to sound convincing.
When Hobbs visits schools to talk about his books, he brings along a slideshow. It starts out with pictures of him when he was their age and quickly moves into photos of the real-life places he's been that have inspired his books. In an interview after his presentation, Hobbs says rural kids who grew up near the outdoors really love his stories.
But you'd be amazed, and this is really gratifying, the kids who live in suburbs and cities the way most of our kids do, this stuff about the outdoors and wilderness, you can say that, you know, fantasy is like is really popular retail. It is. But when kids get a hold of realistic fiction that takes them to some of these wild places in North America, you know, whether it's Grand Canyon or up to the subarctic or Southeast Alaska, they absolutely love it. They eat it up. And when I visit them and they see the pictures and they see that this is all real, it opens up their minds and I think a sense of hope and possibility that these places are still out there. And they get wildly excited about it because it is different from what they see every day.
That's what happened for Ginny Blackson, the librarian at Sitka High School and one of the coordinators of the Alaska Spirit of Reading program. Blackson grew up on her grandparents' tobacco farm in Shipley, Kentucky. With 5,000 people in the entire county, neighbors were few and far between.
And so we went into town on Saturday and went to the public library and got a pile of books. We also had a bookmobile, which was there was a nice lady in a beat-up van who brought books around. But books were really, really the pathway, to the world for us.
A program like the Spirit of Reading is important for many reasons, Blackson says, including for its ability to put books in the hands of kids.
We're a book-poor state. Kids don't have books put in their hand, especially kids in rural areas. We're lucky to have a bookstore here in town. We're lucky to have a fabulous public library here in town. That is not the model in most of the state. And so what I see is just kids with books. And last year I had students who read everything that was in the Sitka Library Network system by Roland Smith, kids I might have never seen in the library before.
Roland Smith was last year's author, and he was the first one to visit Sitka High as part of the program. Most of the books selected for the Spirit of Reading are pitched for upper elementary and middle school age students, so Blackson says she wasn't sure how his visit would go over among the older teenagers at Sitka High.
So I bribed the students, and I said, if you read the book, after the author's presentation, I'll have pizza. It was a mob scene. I ran out of pizza, I ran out of books.
But more than that, she says the kids were actually excited, not just because of the pizza. The Alaska Spirit of Reading program is in its third year, and it's funded by a grant from the Alaska State Library. The grant is running out.
The interlibrary cooperation grants are not meant to go on forever. And so we start off next year looking for a new way to fund it.
She's hoping that the coordination of the program will start rotating around the state. Blackson and Blatchley Middle School librarian Carrie Sagel have been running the program since it started.
Carrie and I go every year to the Alaska Library Association with our little binder and do a presentation and say, this could be your program. But while we get a lot of positive feedback, we haven't had anyone raise their hand and say, oh, we want to take this on.
Even though the program has an uncertain future, Blackson is traveling to a symposium in November to look for an author who might be interested in participating next year. Reporting in Sitka, I'm Ed Ronco.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at aprn.org. You can follow us on Twitter at aprn. We had reports tonight from Ellen Lockyer and Jacqueline Estes from Anchorage, Mike Mason in Dillingham, Dan Bross from Fairbanks, and Ed Ronco from Sitka. APRN's Libby Casey reported from Washington, D.C., and Dave Donaldson from Juneau. Our editor and producer is Annie Feit. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. And I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
the Doyon family of companies working together to build Alaska's future.
And by
NMS, building a culture of safety through active caring. More information online at nmsusa.com.
ACHEA, the Alaska Comprehensive Health Insurance Association, has been asked to administer the new temporary federal insurance program that allows individuals with a qualifying pre-existing condition and who have been uninsured for at least 6 months an opportunity to purchase health insurance. Capacity is limited, so contact an insurance broker or ACHEA immediately. More information at achia.com. This message sponsored by ACHEA Fed.
The Alaska Tobacco Control Alliance has a simple request. If you smoke, take it outside. Smoking hurts more than just you. Secondhand smoke increases the risk of coronary heart disease and kills nearly 50,000 non-smoking Americans every year. Smoking around your kids causes chronic and life-threatening diseases and is linked to sudden infant death syndrome. If you choose to smoke, make a choice that protects others who don't. Take it outside. This message sponsored by the Alaska Tobacco Control Alliance.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.